Hello and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network with me, Naomi Fowler. Coming up later, we go to Bermuda.
There's been an increasing awareness of exactly how regressive our tax system is and the great disparity in income levels, the split between the haves and the have-nots. We also have to recognize the mistakes that we've made in developing the country in the past.
We ask why, despite a large offshore finance industry, so many Bermudians are struggling. But first, here's a quick tax justice news roundup. This month, Apple became the world's first trillion-dollar company. That reflects the fact that corporate concentration of economic power is on the rise in the United States. In 1975, 109 companies collected half of the profits, but today those are captured by just 30 companies. In the UK, we saw what could be the start of some genuine competition and a real challenge to the dominance of the big four accountancy firms who audit 99% of the UK's biggest listed companies. A leading investor, Standard Life Aberdeen, which controls £655 billion worth of assets, has had a series of meetings with FTSE 100 and FTSE 250 company boards to try to convince them to consider appointing a smaller player outside of the big four. They say that's because they, quote, let profits affect audit views, close quotes. They're just not getting a good service. Also in the UK, after transparency rules were enforced in registrations of Scottish tax haven firms or limited partnerships, but those rules weren't applied to English or Northern Irish ones, guess what happened? New evidence shows that there was a 79% reduction in Scottish limited partnership registrations, but a 142% rise in English ones and a 22% rise in Northern Irish ones. We reported on the Wild West of Scottish limited partnerships in edition 49 of the TaxCast. European Union Justice Commissioner Vera Jourova has warned about security risks from EU so-called golden visa programmes, by which member states give citizenship to those investing large sums of money in their countries, with little scrutiny or transparency. Over 863,000 citizenships were granted in 2016. That's a 19% increase compared to the previous year, so it's on the rise. And at the same time, so many desperate people are risking their lives crossing oceans in leaking boats to try to escape to what they hope will be safer, better lives. In Italy, the five-star movement has just backed a dangerously regressive flat tax proposal from their government coalition partner, the far-right Lega Party. The five-star movement's especially popular in the poorer south of Italy. Their election campaign focused on reducing inequality. In Italy, growth of inequality has been one of the highest in the OECD. The party's actually the majority partner in the coalition government there, although they're not behaving like it. If this proposal is implemented, tax collection in Italy will drop dramatically and end up redistributing wealth upwards from the poor to the rich, threatening to destroy Italy's public finances. We hope they'll reconsider. And finally, Imran Khan, who won the election in Pakistan last month, has told Britain he'll retrieve wealth looted from his country and stashed in the UK by corrupt politicians. Remember, the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's been jailed for 10 years after a court found he was unable to explain how he and his family bought four London flats through offshore companies. Let's see what kind of cooperation he gets from the City of London. Those are the news headlines. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. OK, John, some potentially bad news this month. We've seen a fight back against new transparency gains. Over recent years, we've been seeing real movement on opening up financial secrecy services. There's been some key anti-money laundering, anti-corruption, anti-tax dodging measures going through. Remember, 10 years ago, people laughed at the Tax Justice Network's vision. And two of the most significant tax justice victories being challenged now, although they're not perfect, there's plenty of loopholes that we're always quick to point out, that all major countries except the United States have signed up to, is automatic information exchange on the accounts that each of us citizens have overseas, also known as the Common Reporting Standard. The second one being challenged now is the UK's public register of the real owners of companies, which was introduced in 2016. And we saw last year the European Union passing a directive requiring all member states to implement similar registers. So that was good. We want that to go further. Obviously, we want public registers of foundations and trusts as well. That's another conversation. What's going on? Tell us about this challenge, this backlash that we're seeing against those two policies.
Yep, so this story has been boiling away under the surface for quite a long time. Listeners won't be surprised to hear that there are many users of tax havens who resent transparency measures, which might expose their tax evasion or other crimes to the tax authorities of their countries of residence. Back in 2015, I was told by a senior official at the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris that they expected a legal challenge to what's called the Common Reporting Standard, the new global standard for automatic information exchange. I've also heard from a number of lawyers, including offshore lawyers, that they were utterly opposed to the requirement that from 2020 onwards, all European Union member states will need to make company ownership information available on public registry, which is already the case in the United Kingdom. And what's happening across Europe is that they are removing the legitimate interest proviso, which previously applied, which said that this information would only be made available to people with a legitimate interest. So you had to prove that the information was relevant to you before you could get access to it. That's going. And needless to say, there's a backlash. And that backlash has come from a London law firm called Mishkon de Rea, who are reportedly acting on behalf of a client who's resident in Italy. But this person apparently has an offshore bank account in London and has filed a formal complaint to the United Kingdom Information Commission, and the complaint's being made under the newly adopted European Union General Data Protection Regulation, which covers the entire European Union. And the complaint charges that the automatic information exchange processes under the Common Reporting Standards, plus the public registration of company ownership information, infringes the client's right to privacy and to data protection. According to Mishkon de Rea, information exchange renders the client vulnerable, and I'm quoting here, to risks of hacking and to data loss, and could lead to identity theft.
Okay, so where does the Tax Justice Network stand on this?
Well, for our part, Tax Justice Network has campaigned for well over a decade for automatic information exchange to be the global standard. And we have also campaigned for exactly the same length of time for full disclosure on public registry of the full information about beneficial owners. But we also have always expected that tax authorities receiving information through the automatic information exchange process will take all appropriate steps necessary to protect any data they receive. But surely that would apply to all taxpayers, not just to taxpayers who are holding offshore accounts. So I don't see why offshore accounts should be given preferential treatment. If there's a vulnerability to hacking, and there shouldn't be really, but if there is, then we are all equally vulnerable to it. And we all equally have rights to appropriate levels of data protection. Now, as far as beneficial ownership information is concerned, the Panama Papers and the revelations of the Paradise Papers have revealed beyond a shadow of doubt, as far as we're concerned, the extent of criminal and corrupt activities that are hidden behind secretive offshore companies. So we think that the rights to privacy need to be considered in the wider context of the public's legitimate interest in fighting against tax evasion, against fraud, insider trading, cheating creditors, embezzlement and looting, and all of the other crimes that are perpetrated and go largely uninvestigated because the crooks have hidden their identity behind an offshore company. So we think that a public interest argument should override the right to privacy argument when it comes to companies and making company ownership information available on public registry. Now, time will tell whether the Mishkon de Rea complaint will be upheld. Rights to privacy need to be balanced against the state's duty to tax fairly and to raise all the necessary resources to fund human rights on such matters as education, health, security and social justice.
Right, and there's matters of national security potentially as well. It really doesn't seem fair, does it, that some people can be buying into services that will put them into some kind of higher tier of sort of exclusivity where they can sort of buy their way out of scrutiny in a way that ordinary people really can't.
Yes, yes. And the plaintiff in this case, the person who's resident in Italy, is claiming, well, there's not a great deal of money on my account, and so it's too intrusive, and there should be some kind of threshold. As far as I'm concerned, that's a nonsense, because most people's bank accounts go up and down over the course of the month or the year. Certainly mine does, as and when I receive my salary and so on. So bank accounts can hold a small amount at one moment and a very large amount at another if you're a very wealthy person. So I think the volume of money on the account at any one stage should not be taken as a guide to whether or not this is a disproportionate measure.
Right. There's another point as well, isn't there, about limited liability companies? And if people don't want to be identified, then perhaps don't open a limited liability company, right?
That's absolutely right, because limited liability brings a whole load of privileges and special protections, but it should also bring responsibilities. And one of those responsibilities, we think, and it's not unreasonable to say that the people who actually own and benefit from having this limited liability company should be prepared to make their information, their personal information, available on public record. And there's very good reason for that, because let's face it, many creditors have been cheated because they found out that they don't actually know who owns the company. Tax authorities have been cheated. And as I said earlier, the Panama Papers have revealed a huge amount of corrupt practices, criminal activities, and more general abuses hidden behind these offshore companies.
Right, and I should just mention as well that Mishkon de Rea is the same law firm threatening libel action in the UK against the murdered journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia, and also against Malta Today, also the same firm acting on behalf of the Maltese Passports for Sale agents, Henley and Partners. So they have history in this area. OK, let's move on. We discussed last month in the TaxCast the danger of lobbyists posing as think tanks, which don't declare their funders. One such organisation in the UK we discussed is the Institute for Economic Affairs. And we talked about the investigation by the Charity Commission into their educational charity status. And they're also facing an investigation by the British government's lobbying watchdog to determine whether they should be registered as a lobbyist and therefore be obliged to disclose their financial donors. So that's all very interesting. Now, what's happened since the last TaxCast is that it's come out that a report that was rubbishing the idea that offshore financial centres were so-called hotbeds of tax evasion, turns out it was paid for by the Jersey financial services sector, which was something that they didn't disclose in what they were portraying as an Institute for Economic Affairs discussion paper.
Yes, so this is a story about the generation of what I think most people would see as fake news. As you say, last month in the TaxCast, we discussed how think tanks hide their funding sources in order to avoid disclosing that they are really lobbyists masquerading as think tanks. Since last month, there's been a very interesting twist to this story. Thanks to a sting operation by an investigating journalist, we now know that the IEA writes reports on behalf of corporate clients without disclosing in the reports when they're put out to the public that they have been paid for by the corporate clients, and also arranges meetings with government ministers and others to conduct lobbying activities. The report was commissioned by the tax haven lobby, which calls itself Jersey Finance, which lobbies on behalf of banks and other finance businesses in Jersey. So we're not surprised that the report, which was issued just a few weeks ago, dismisses critics of tax havens and argues that tax havens are vitally important to investment flows across borders. But let's face it, the real purpose was not to engage in academic debate with the critics. It was to provide an opportunity for generating media coverage in favour of tax havens and to give politicians who support tax havens an opportunity to confuse and mislead public opinion. So we've got to ask ourselves, who's the real villain of the story here? Is it Jersey Finance? And the answer there is no, Jersey Finance just doing their job. They're a lobbying organisation. Is it the IEA? And they fed this out to the British media and generated favourable publicity for tax havens. But in this case, I think we would argue that the media are to blame, and in particular Britain's main media news outlet, which is the BBC. In the interests of protecting public confidence in broadcasting independence, we must now campaign for the BBC to adopt basic transparency standards, like, for example, revealing the source of your funding. I think the BBC needs to reconsider its position on balance and freedom of speech, because freedom of speech, as George Orwell rightly said, does not give the right to lobbyists to insist that 2 + 2 = 5.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. The British Overseas Territory of Bermuda is ranked 36th in the Tax Justice Network's Financial Secrecy Index. It's got a secrecy score of 73 out of 100, so some very high levels of secrecy. It would be higher in the ranking, but there are much bigger players out there. Remember, the index combines secrecy levels on all sorts of services with significance in terms of size globally. Bermuda's really big on providing offshore insurance services in particular. In fact, its offshore industry dominates the economy, with billions flowing through this tiny, beautiful island. Well, actually, the territory consists of 181 islands, a bit over 53 square kilometres and about 60,000 people. This month, on the TaxCast, we ask, why are so many Bermudians leaving? And why has Bermuda's income inequality escalated to among the highest in the world?
The government's only published an estimate of poverty once. There's severe resistance to it.
This is Bermudian economist Robert Stubbs, formerly head of research for the Bank of Bermuda.
I think it was done in 2007 using data from 2004. Officially, it showed a poverty level of 13.5%, but I think that's a low estimate. I think it was probably closer to 16 or 17%.
So that was 14 years ago. Who knows what the inequality levels are now, today, right? And that's despite all the money pouring into the island through its financial services sector. Most governments do measure things like inequality levels, child poverty and things like that, but Bermuda doesn't have an up-to-date system for doing that.
Yeah, you've got some people in the country that are doing very well with fantastically paying compensated income from jobs. But there's also severe economic difficulty. The economy has never really emerged from the 2008 crisis. So there's a lot of unemployment. There's a lot of underemployment. Wages for lower skilled jobs, like most countries around the world, haven't kept up with the higher paying jobs. So there's multiple reasons why income inequality has risen to the levels that it has in Bermuda. I mean, fundamentally, we've got to turn the economy around and start creating more jobs. But we've also got to address the fact that low income people in Bermuda just are living with poverty wages. And we've got to do something about raising their income levels to a more respectable level. So there is initiative by government, it's recognized by both parties, to implement a living wage in Bermuda, but progress on that's painfully slow.
One of the big factors helping to impoverish people is the effect of what we call the finance curse. Part of that is that the influx of foreign labour to work in the finance sector and all sorts of other incentives designed to attract the wealthy have contributed to a housing crisis in Bermuda, which already had comparatively low levels of home ownership. Now many Bermudians are finding their rents have got higher and higher, and those who have jobs, and even those working several jobs, are falling into the category of the working poor.
And we just look around and we watch the rent go higher. Electricity and water and everything that you need, laundry, goes higher, you know, and it's just everything's rising above us besides our wages.
I make like $300-something a week, but I don't get it until the end of the month. That adds up to $1,500, and my rent is $1,450.
I think to pay rent here is the biggest issue. And I'm also looking for an apartment. But the struggles with that is that I don't have the money up front to pay down on this apartment plus the month's rent, what people are looking for.
The rent today is probably the most important part as far as how mothers or families are managing. You know, I know years ago you used to pay like $700 for a one bedroom, and now you're paying anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000-$3,000. So technically you find yourself, and even though you do make a good wage, you find yourself making money or being paid just to be able to live. I'm finding it hard in Bermuda right now, raising a family.
I have a lot of bills that I owe, and the way how I'm working and being paid, I can pay the rent, pay the lights, buy food.
If I don't have electricity, and many of these women do not have electricity because it's been turned off, I can't store fresh food in my refrigerator. I will have to buy pre-prepared food, which is much more expensive and most of the time not very healthy. And I can't buy in bulk, so I'm going to be buying small quantities of everything. So these sort of things add up and become a kind of a ball and chain, in a way, for someone who's poor.
At the Coalition, we have a food storehouse where families can come in to get groceries, and we've seen the demand go through the roof. Probably in the past year, we've had a tripling of mothers coming in seeking assistance. And they're coming in for a variety of reasons, primarily food aid, but also electricity bills. They often have letters of non-payment, meaning their electricity is going to be turned off. Medical bills that have been referred to debt collectors, school uniforms, just a variety of things.
By the time they take over my insurance, pension, and payroll tax, that's my money right there going.
At the end of the day, once all the deductions and everything comes out, it doesn't send you home with much. And it's hard as a single parent to look at my paycheck every week and divide it up and say, okay, what am I going to pay? What am I not going to pay? Can I afford to sacrifice this? And then if I sacrifice this again, will I be able to catch up next week?
Electricity bills got neglected because it was a matter of eating, feeding your child, or paying the electricity bill.
I had to find places to sleep, caves, bathrooms, parks, beaches, until I was 7 months pregnant.
While I was homeless, I paid off three bills. You know, so it wasn't a matter of just lounging around with nowhere to go, just living it up.
I see a lot of homeless people, way more than I saw last year, and way more than I saw the year before. And I wonder, just like violence and crime, what next year will bring for us?
Those are Bermudians speaking to the filmmakers of Poverty in Paradise. Right, Robert, so there's a newish government in Bermuda. Government debt there is really high. They're aware of the need to address poverty and inequality. Problem is, there's a famously strongly held position in the island on maintaining low or no taxes, and there's a heavy reliance, therefore, as in many of these island nations, on consumption taxes or sales taxes, which hit the poorest the most.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you have to tax something. And if you're not going to be in Bermuda, we don't tax capital income. So the system has always been heavily reliant upon consumption taxes. In our case, it's customs duties on imported merchandise. So, yeah, that's a primary reason or source of our regressivity. But there's a reluctance to increase spending by government. Obviously, that will require higher taxes, and it will require higher taxes, especially from those who have more ability to pay. And there's severe resistance to this. I mean, that ultimately that gets down to addressing the regressivity of the tax system and fundamentally reforming our taxes. And the government's in the process of studying this. There's a tax reform commission that has been formed that is going to be coming back with a report to government advising how they suggest that the tax system should be fundamentally reformed. But there's been a significant resistance in Bermuda to the taxation of capital income. There is no taxation of capital income. And the result of that is that higher income people have got a much lower tax burden than low income, to the degree that people in the upper end of the income distribution are paying about half of what the lower income people are paying in terms of total tax burden of direct and indirect taxes paid.
Right. And the finance sector is far too big for the island. It's oversized. I mean, it's between 39 to 41% of the economy, similar in the UK Crown Dependencies of Guernsey and Jersey. That's an obvious danger economically, too many eggs in one basket. That really doesn't help inequality levels or the development of alternative business and industry, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The locals have suffered by the lack of diversity in the economy. And there's the tremendous expansion of finance and the import of high paying foreign labor. It increases the costs in the country. It increases the cost of housing and multiple other costs. And the local population, their standard of living really suffers. So there's a widespread recognition, I think, in all these islands that we have to diversify the economy.
And the benefits of Bermuda's finance sector to ordinary Bermudians are sometimes hard to find.
Yeah, there obviously are benefits, but it's very localized. It's not broad based. The majority of the population don't see the benefits. It obviously benefits certain owners of commercial property, the offices that these people work in. The owners of the houses that they rent, they obviously are benefiting. And then there's the Bermudians who work in the industry, our international business, so we're talking primarily reinsurance companies. They don't employ as many locals as the finance industry in, say, Cayman or Jersey. Their finance industries have got a far greater local content. Within the reinsurance companies, about half the underwriters are Bermudian. Only about 15% of the actuaries are. And about 50% of their overall staff is Bermudian locals. So there's a very significant foreign content to their staff.
Right. And offshore services in the British Overseas Territories are being slowly squeezed, as with many jurisdictions, with some of the moves towards transparency globally. We've also had this vote in the British Parliament recently, which means all overseas territories will have to create public registers of the real owners of companies, as the UK does. What was the reaction to that in Bermuda? And do you think it might encourage more planning and more movement towards economic diversification?
I think so. I don't think it's going to influence Bermuda's business as much as it'll affect some of the other islands. There's very mixed opinion on this. The government seems to be using this to advance some of their political ambitions. But amongst the public in Bermuda, there's very mixed opinion. I mean, you know, typically amongst the lawyers and the accountants, they're opposed to it. But the vast majority of Bermudians, I think, are actually in favor of it. And, you know, our business isn't heavily dependent upon trust companies or banking. I don't think the reinsurers will be affected by this move.
It'll still focus minds, though. Although what we've been seeing in recent years in many jurisdictions is that instead of creating alternative, sustainable, beneficial employment possibilities, they're going for quite problematic money spinners like passports and residency for sale, and many tax havens are moving into cryptocurrency. Going back to Bermuda, there's development of a so-called service exchange called Arbitrade. Many think that's an accident waiting to happen for Bermuda. But I'm just wondering, what kind of taxes does the finance sector pay at the moment, given Bermuda's huge debt and poverty problems, and considering the size of it, which is, as I said, between 39 to 41% of the economy? What kind of contribution in terms of tax revenue does it make to Bermuda?
So this hasn't been spoken about publicly in any great detail, but the Bermuda government first imposed fees on international businesses in 1966. And at the time, those fees, they generated 7% of the Bermuda government revenues. Those fees are still in place. They've increased slightly over time, but as a percentage of the government revenues, they haven't increased at all. And yet, in the meantime, of course, international business since the 1960s, it's grown enormously in Bermuda. The international companies themselves will be quick to point to the amount of payroll tax that they pay. In our Bermuda government's payroll tax and levying the payroll tax, they mandate that a certain portion of it be paid by the companies. And the companies will argue that, you know, this raises significant amount of revenue for the Bermuda government and should be counted as a major contribution to the government and the economy. But, you know, that is ignoring the incidence of this taxation really is agreed by economists around the world to be borne by labor, to be borne by the employees. So it really should be viewed as a contribution to Bermuda government revenues made by the employees of these companies as opposed to the company itself. And I would argue that their contribution to the Bermuda government revenues is still only 7% of the government's budget. And in comparison to the size of the industry, and in consideration of the risks that Bermuda faced regarding the possibility of further global financial crises and its potential impact on the local economy here, I think they should be paying significantly more.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that you point out in your work, which you can read on the Tax Justice Network blog, by the way, that Jersey and Guernsey are also contending with inequality and poverty levels, which for developed high-income countries are also pretty extreme. They suffer as well from the lack of a really diversified economy. And yet they do see, the Bermudian government does see the need for tax reform, which is interesting. Other than the huge government debt, why are they looking so seriously at tax reform now, do you think?
Well, this is there's been an increasing awareness of all of this in the last 3 or 4 years of exactly how regressive our tax system is. And the great disparity in income levels, the split between the haves and the have-nots. So this was a major election issue in our general election last summer. And we haven't recovered really from the 2008 crisis still. And this finance curse, the lack of diversification of the economy, it's resulted in the loss of Bermudian jobs ever since 2000. This was an ongoing phenomenon prior to the 2008 crisis. The peak in Bermudian jobs was the year 2000, and we've been losing jobs ever since. So this is a major political issue. And tax reform is part of it. I've been arguing that our tax structure is actually one of the major reasons why the economy is struggling. So it has to be a significant component of how we're going to turn the economy around and start creating jobs again.
Absolutely. So what would you like to see happen with this tax reform, ideally?
Well, we have to broaden the tax base, so be less reliant upon the few areas that we are taxing. We have to implement some form of capital income taxation and broaden the consumption taxes to include services. In addition to that, overall, it has to start generating greater income for the government. You know, in all of this, we've had budget deficits. Our budget deficit ballooned out after 2008, and our government's debt has increased by about $2 billion over the last 10 years. So that's, for an island of 60,000 people, that's not bad going.
Yeah, that sounds pretty serious. How would you tackle the finance sector and the fact that it is so overly large? I mean, how can Bermudians start thinking about some solid economic diversification plans? The Tax Justice Network's argued for a long time that the United Kingdom has a responsibility to assist with investment for economic development, having encouraged many overseas territories in the first place to go down the financial services route.
Well, I think, you know, each country really has to do an analysis of what its real strengths are. You know, what benefits do you offer? We're all going to, you know, have our unique aspects, and you really have to recognize those and take advantage of those and recognize those in your development plans. Tourism, you know, given the beauty of the island and how friendly and hospitable the people are, tourism should always be a major component of Bermuda's economy. And that's been neglected over the years. And that's definitely something that we need to continue to work on. There's all kinds of things that we could do to attract more tourists. But I would say, you know, we also have to recognize the mistakes we've been making. And, you know, my argument to the government is we really need to be mindful of what government can do to have the greatest impact on business prospects, on economic growth over the long term. And that's through providing good education and making the necessary adjustments to improve the quality of life. So there's all kinds of, you know, bigger things that have to be addressed in terms of transportation and infrastructure spending and urban development. So I'm trying to get the government to recognize the mistakes that we've made in developing the country in the past. You know, governments really have to be thinking along these lines to promote economic growth in the future.
The Tax Justice Network's now working with people in the UK overseas territories and other small island nation tax havens to contribute perspectives on alternative development paths to diversify their economies in ways that will benefit the majority of citizens. We'll be covering that more on the TaxCast. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.